Wow. It's a very strange gospel. Let's just put that on the table. Normally we think of Jesus as the good guy, the hero, the one that we can trust, the one that we can always turn to. Here he's presented, first as seemingly indifferent. He answers another word, and then goes into this insulting argument before her. I mean, if in the moment of prayer, you know, you're desperate in need, you're just wanting something from God and you're pouring your heart out to God, I mean, how would you react? What would your response be if this is the kind of thing that Jesus said to you? I'm not going to give you anything now. I'm not going to answer your deepest needs. You're nothing more than a dog. I mean, how insulting is that? It's just this dreadful insult. And yet, there is this possibility that is awakened within this woman. And she's not defeated by this. She's able to stand her ground and cry out to Jesus and offer, one of these great one-liners, one of these great retorts that are splattered across the pages of great literature, the sense of this repertoire, this retort that happens between two people. And she's able to offer this rebuff, and she receives the greatest and deepest desire of her heart. To get a sense of this, to try and work out what on earth is actually happening in this gospel. I mean, first, the liturgy gives us some interpretive clues today. We're first given that great prophecy from Isaiah in chapter 56. It's in the final section of the three major sections of this prophecy. Written after the exile, the first part of Isaiah is written before things all fall apart, before the Babylonians completely destroy the city of Jerusalem and the temple and everything that had been the hopes and dreams of the Jewish people until that point. But here in Isaiah 56, we're in the final section, written perhaps 200 years after the first part. And this sense of longing for the people to be restored, but also this sense of them waking up finally to God's ultimate purpose. That yes, Israel first, the people of God first, they are the ones to be the chosen people to lead other nations. I mean, you think back to the call of Abram, or Abraham, back in Genesis 12, this sense that he was called to be a sign and a blessing, not just for one people, not just for one nation, not just for one family, but for all the world, all nations. So Israel first, but all nations. And so here in Isaiah 56, we are told, as long as foreigners and outsiders are faithful to God's commandments, they will be welcome. There will be a place on God's holy mountain for them to come and to join in the feast and the festival. And in Romans today, we get Paul, who was, of course, the apostle to the Gentiles. Peter was the one who was kind of appointed to the Jewish faithful to bring them into the belief in the Messiah. But Paul is the one who goes beyond the boundaries of Israel and begins to call people into union with God from all nations and beyond the borders. And so he's also saying, this sense that all people, all nations are able to experience this wonder. And it makes then the contrast that we find in the gospel today even more striking, even more challenging. What, again, is going on? Matthew takes the story that Mark gave us. Mark was the first of the Gospels to be written, and we follow the order and the structure of Mark's Gospel very closely when we come into Matthew. He makes these small changes, these subtle variations that are very important for him and for his sense of mission. So we're told today that Jesus heads towards the region of Tyre and Sidon, up on the coast in the north of Israel, modern-day Lebanon. And this sense of Jesus at least going towards this pagan territory. See, just to get away from the crowds. He needs some space to be with his disciples to continue to pray. It was only in last Sunday's gospel that we first heard Jesus going by himself to pray, to be by himself. That sense of just needing to recharge. And so he goes up there to the region towards the region of Tyre and Sidon, perhaps still in Jewish land, perhaps still within that sense of still within the region that is dominated by the Jewish people. Because Matthew is very insistent on this, that first Jesus will teach and preach and proclaim the gospel to his own people. And later, when Jesus sends out the disciples, He tells them, you know, don't go to the foreign cities, don't go to foreign areas, just stay within the areas of the children of Israel. So Matthew wants us to see that that's Jesus' mission, to stay first within the Jewish people. And so, you know, that explains some of this. Okay, so he's just wanting to stay within the Jewish community. He's already healed the centurion. He's already healed, like, that's a Roman, a foreigner. So he's already breaking his own rules. So why does this woman get this rebuff? I mean, part of the beauty of the way that Jewish meditation literature and all of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and the Gospels are written by Jewish people within that sense of giving us some details, but not giving us enough. You know, we're not told the name of this woman, we're not told the background, we don't get any kind of sense of what happened to her afterwards. She's just kind of dropped into the story. And so when we have these questions, it's a good thing. You know, we shouldn't try and just resolve everything and try and say, oh, well, this must have been the way that it all happened and all unfolded. No, often we're not given enough detail. You know, we're used to that sense of storytelling where an author will give us pages and pages of background information and describe the characters in detail and tell us all about the setting and how things were all happening and unfolding at that particular moment. The Bible doesn't give that. The Bible doesn't tell us the details that we want. And so we're often just dropped into this story and left going, huh? What is this? What is happening? What is unfolding in this moment? And we're invited to meditate upon it. I mean, maybe Jesus was smiling as he offers this rebuke to the woman. Maybe there is this sense of they're just looking and there's this joy and laughter that's already present. We don't know what's happening, what's unfolding. And yet there is this invitation that happens, and she responds so well, so brilliantly, so perfectly. And perhaps it's because of her provocation, because of her rebuke to Jesus, that he begins to change his understanding. Perhaps he's formed and shaped in his humanity by this interaction, and he begins to see, no, the Gentiles, the people who are outside the people of God, are also capable of great faith. Remember last week when Jesus is there on the water and he's beginning to sink and get back in the boat? Jesus says to him, why did you doubt? Why did you have such little faith? And then what does he say to the woman today? Woman, you have great faith. So there are these contrasts. Faith is the key. Faith is the object. Faith is the desire. It's this invitation for us to be challenged, to try and struggle with all of these questions, to make sense of these things within our own context and within our own understanding. But we're invited today, above all, simply to trust. There will often be times and situations where we don't know what's going on. We can't understand it. And yet, we're invited to have faith, to trust, and to continue to give our hearts and lives to the one who has loved us, who has called us, and who will be able, as in this case, to instantly answer our deepest longings and provide the help that we need.